And a one and a two. Hello. Welcome. Oh my God, my voice. Oh, dude. I love my baby. Best thing that's ever happened in my life. Like, but the bugs he finds at daycare. Good Lord. Hello. Welcome to Eyes for Ears, your ophthalmology OCAS support of you podcast. I'm your host, Ben Young.
And this is Andrew Powell. Just a reminder that these episodes are meant for medical education only, not to diagnose anything on anyone's eyes.
Each week, we take a high-yield topic and talk about the why and the how. What are we talking about this week, Andrew?
You have selected toxocariasis, and it's going to be a gnarly one, you say.
Yeah. I don't think we have any like explicit warnings in our podcast, but this one may be our first that earns it in terms of talking about the life cycle of this very peculiar roundworm that unfortunately can affect the eye. So if you're eating, finish perhaps before continuing to listen. If you have small children nearby, distract them.
I feel like I recall thinking this wasn't that big of a deal, but maybe I just didn't understand it, or you are also just really making the horror come alive in this retelling.
I've seen a couple horror movies like in the modern day, and man, dude, I think they could really touch up their script if they read some Ryan's retina about Toxicara. But let's get into it. I think, first of all, this is not toxoplasmosis. I remember when I was like, I think of PGY2, I was like confused as heck, because we'll see, there's a lot of similarities between toxocariasis and toxoplasma in terms of presentation, but they're completely different. So I think that's part of why I think it's important to go over. It's a lot more rare than toxoplasmosis too, but you've got to be able to know the difference, because the treatment and everything is very different. What organisms cause toxocariasis, Andrew?
Toxocara canis and Toxocara cati? Cati?
Yeah. Katie? Cat. I think it's cat. I don't think it's Katie. Maybe it's Katie. Sorry, Katie's out there. If you share a name with a roundworm. Yeah, the most common one, it's the canis version, which you might expect is one that lives in dogs. But the cat eye version also presents in kittens. I think this will probably be the last time we have to mention cat eye, because the majority of the time it's canis from dogs. Just every time you hear us talk about dogs or puppies, replace it with cats or kittens. And it's a possible but rare to happen with cats. Yeah, let's just get right into the life cycle of Toxicara. I think it's important to know because it informs the manifestations and how it can present in humans. So it's a definitive dog roundworm. How we can start the life cycle is the nematodes live and grow up in the dog intestine. And then once they reach adulthood at about 6 months, then they start releasing thousands of eggs, which are passed in the stool. Okay. The eggs, by the way, can last a really long time when they are like out of the stool into the environment in like a sandbox or the grass or the butt hairs of your dog. You know, they can last a really long time once they're like in egg form. And that's important to know in terms of like risks and contact. But it's the contact with the eggs that lead to human infection. It cannot go through its life cycle in humans. So you'll never, humans, like if you find out a child has it, you don't have to worry about them contaminating others or infecting like, you know, their brother or sister or whatnot. As you'll hear, they can only go through the whole life cycle in puppies. So that's like the part that's important in terms of contact, is it grows up, dog, cat intestine, and then ends up somehow in your human, usually a child, but it could be adults too. But after the eggs are eaten, you know, they'll enter the intestines, and then they have to be in intestines of some other animal, a mammal, to then hatch into larva. So you eat an egg, the eggs, probably multiple eggs, hatch into larva. Then the horrifying thing is that they are specifically designed to tunnel through the intestinal wall. So little larvae, they kind of look like little tunnel, like drills, not tunnel. They look like little drills. They go through the intestinal wall. Then they'll travel by either the portal system to the liver or the lymphatic system to your lungs until they can get from either direction to your heart and then go all over your body. So in humans, this ends their life cycle, because our immune systems, even though they get into our muscle, liver, lungs, brains, hearts, eyes, our immune systems are usually then good at going crazy walling them off with an eosinophilic granuloma. But then we have to deal with the consequences of larvae migrating and spreading all throughout our bodies. But let's go back to dogs to understand the full life cycle. So the larva's real goal is to go from those intestines into the puppy's lungs. Then they want to get coughed up by the puppy, then get swallowed again, where they can re-enter the intestines and then finish their transition to adulthood and make eggs. Notably, this can only happen in puppies for some reason. There's something about like the hormones or something about the puppies. So if an adult dog gets a dog over 6 months, they can't complete this life cycle for some reason. The one exception is a pregnant mama dog. I don't want to read the technical term that's in the textbooks. So I'll just call them mama dogs. A pregnant or lactating mama dog can allow the larvae to survive as well and transmit either through the placenta or through breast milk of the mama dog. And that's actually how most puppies are infected, is from a mama dog that transfects through breast milk or placentas, if anyone cares. We don't have to know that as ophthalmologists, but I thought that was interesting.
That's all lovely. It's basically a mix of, I don't know, some your worst cooking show nightmare ever mixed with Ridley Scott's Alien movie.
It's so insane. Like, why would their goal be to get coughed up and then eaten again? Like, why? I can't understand why that would be like an advantageous like evolutionary route, you know? I can't even think of like an analog where that would make any sense. But here we are. That's the life cycle of Toxocara. So I guess to draw from that, like the reason I told that sickly tale is it informs somewhat what the risks are of a human acquiring it. Can you go through some of those, Andrew?
Yeah. If you eat dirt, that's not going to be great for you. The technical term geophagia, deliberate consumption of earth, soil, or clay. That applies if you're playing in sandboxes, or if, of course, if you're exposed to puppies and kittens, especially the young ones. You've got some stats here on prevalence in puppies, I suppose.
Yeah.
Go into that, Ben.
Yeah, the puppy thing is pretty real. Like, 80% of puppies have been estimated to be infected with Toxocara canis at some point, you know?
Great. My brother-in-law just got a puppy.
Yeah, it was just played with that totally thing. Just don't eat their poop and wash your hands. You'll be totally fine. But the puppies are like basically egg factories. Until the puppy is 6 months old, which is when the adult worms get to 6 months old, and that's when they die. They have like a pretty, you know, short-ish lifespan, but from like 2 to 6 months, these puppies can pump out eggs. But congrats to your brother on the new puppy. That's exciting. What kind of dog is it?
Poodle.
Oh, that's cute. So, you know, older dogs can acquire it, but the numbers dropped down to like 20% after the puppies are 6 months old. So, but it's like pretty prevalent, but it's important to get that history. There should be puppy exposure or exposure to sandboxes where, like, you know, if it's like near a dog park or something, or dog walkers tend to walk by that area, you kind of never know. And hopefully these are illustrate why this is most prevalent in children. That is definitely the predominant etiology, but adults can get it too. You know, I've had patients in their 50s get it. I think the record in the literature is a 62-year-old that got it. It's just that adults tend to not, you know, play in sandboxes or interact with, you know, in this fashion, but it's definitely possible. And I guess the other thing to know is because the larva can end up in muscle, is raw meat is also a potential source, or like water or other food that are contaminated with the eggs in some way. So like, that's a potential cause, just like in toxoplasma, where raw meat is actually the most common way to interact with the life cycle. It's possible, but it's more common, we think, in humans to contract it by interacting with puppy feces in some way. So, yeah. And unfortunately, it is relatively common for the general population to acquire it. You know, there's various estimates. I saw a study looking at, there's a study that was looking at like a population in North Carolina. They just did serum testing and found like 13% of the population that they were testing had positive antibodies to these larvae. You know, there's other studies. I think it was another country that found it was like 23% of the population had exposure. So it is pretty common for humans to acquire it. But luckily, as we'll go into, even if you have acquired it at some point in your life, it does not mean that you are going blind from it. Because there are two major manifestations of Toxocara. Can you list them for us, Andrew?
Yes, sir. Happy to be your Vanna White today, Ben. There is, of the two, the one we care about more, ocular larva migrans, OLM. It will focus on that mostly. But the other manifestation is visceral larva migrans, VLM. And VLM, visceral larva migrans, doesn't really overlap much. If you have OLM, you're unlikely to have VLM as well. Only about 5% of the time do those two things manifest in concordance with each other. And visceral larva migrans, a little bit more we'll say about it right now before we dive into OLM. VLM is usually self-limiting in children. Now the kids, and this is going to draw you back to Ben's horrifying life cycle story. Kiddos, human kiddos, can get transient pulmonary opacities when they have VLM. So is the roundworm trying to migrate to their lungs? Sounds like it. Yikes. Even in bad cases, they can even penetrate the human child's heart or brain. So VLM thankfully doesn't seem to do too much usually, but when it rarely seems like it can do bad stuff.
Yeah, I think the idea is it typically maybe like minimally symptomatic, like maybe the kid has some like mild pulmonary symptoms, a little bit of fever, it's thought of as just a cold, and they get over it and that's it. And it just happens if you do a chest x-ray, you might see this like transient pulmonary opacities, which are probably eosinophilic granulomas. If you do CBC testing when they have visceral larva migrans, they might have eosinophilia. But, I think the idea, because the exposure rate seems to be so high, is that they're usually like seen as minor illnesses that go away, you know, in a lot of these children, and don't, as far as we know, leave kind of like long-term consequences that we get worried about. But, you know, I think you pointed out something interesting, Andrew, that people who present with ocular larva migrans do not also present with visceral larva migrans. There's only like a 5% concordance between those presentations. And it's curious as to why, given the life cycle. The stuff that I try to find in the literature seems mainly speculative, but here's like the basic idea is if you ingest a larger dose of eggs, so if you eat a lot of eggs,
Gaston.
Toxocara. Yeah, exactly. If you're Gaston from the Disney classic Beauty and the Beast, then you will get VLM. And if you take a smaller dose at one time, then you'd be more likely to get OLM. Why is that? The thought is if you have a larger dose, then your body goes crazy with the eosinophilia and the immune response, limiting the spread. So maybe it gets to your liver or lungs, but it doesn't go beyond that. But if you have a smaller dose, your body may not mount quite as robust an immune response, not as much eosinophilia. So it may be able to kind of sneak around these little larvae literally crawling around in your bloodstream and in your tissues until it gets to your eye. And then maybe in the rest of your body, it wreaks havoc, but in the odd immunologically privileged area of your eye, then it can hang out for a while until it causes all the damage we were about to talk about. Also along these routes, and I think it relates to this dose difference, that VLM tends to present in children who are younger. Average age is about 2 years. And OLM, the ocular variety we care about, average age is older, about 7.5 years. But there's definitely a range, right? Like, a two-year-old can definitely get ocular larva migrans. And as you mentioned earlier, adults can get it. You know, it can be 45 years old, 60-year-old. I've seen a 50-year-old can get, you know, ocular larva migrans. But average age is about 8 years old to present with the OLM.
I'm going to just think in my head that dose-dependent manifestation difference you said is memorable by thinking that a little child such as your own adorable bundle of joy would not stop itself necessarily from shoveling a whole crap ton of dog poop into their gullet.
Everything goes in his mouth right now. Yeah. Correct. Absolutely.
So
I was thinking getting a puppy around now. I will, like, I don't want any parent out there with a puppy to be like terrified, you know, or anything of this. But it's just because I was reading into this, I want to hold off a little bit until we get that puppy. It's
probably a good call for your sanity too.
Just for my sanity. I don't want anyone to, you know, vast majority, this is rare. It's like 1% of like uveitic patients will get toxic car. It's very rare, but yeah, just it's more sanity and like imagining this life cycle to stare at little puppies now. Well, maybe we'll get one that's like older than 6 months. I don't know.
You want me to go into the OLM presentation a bit?
Yeah, but this is your motivation to adopt. Not that it's wrong to have a smaller puppy.
Puppies allowed to work, guys. You're all busy residents. Don't
do it. Yeah. 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 One of my fellows just got like a puppy and he's doing very well, but it's a lot. So what does it look like when it finally makes it to the eye, Andrew?
Yeah, so we'll leave VLM behind a bit, talking specifically about ocular larva migrants. And, you know, stop me anywhere, Ben, if your experience with this as the retina doc amongst us can inform more specifically. OLM, usually unilateral, 90% of the time just in one eye. It's characterized by this central posterior granuloma, which shows up about a quarter to half the time. And this is that white retinal choroidal lesion that you can kind of sort of see, except there's going to be some vitritis. You're seeing it through. You know, this is where it shares a lot in common with toxoplasmosis, which is very frequently referred to as that headlight in the fog appearance. Now, we don't say headlight in the fog for toxocara. And in toxocara, it's not just this flat retinochoroidal lesion. It's actually this slightly elevated granuloma that's back there that looks kind of off-white. And I just, you know, thought, oh, granuloma, okay, whatever. But earlier off-air, Ben, you clarified for me, no, that is even more horrifying than I had always thought because the roundworm is somewhere in that granuloma. It's probably dead. It's probably dead and decaying, probably totally more or less killed by the body's inflammatory response, which is what creates the granuloma around it. But good golly, that is horrifying. You got the dead corpse of a worm in your eye.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's really what the main issue is like the larva gets to your eye, then your body's like, whoa, 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 what the heck? And then makes an eosinophilic granuloma around this thing. And that murders it. But it's like having a dead worm larva in your eye causes like all these complications.
Sorry, I was going to clarify. When I said that this is a quarter to half the time likely, that's if the posterior granuloma is centrally located, like around the macula or between the arcades. But the other like quarter to half the time, it can be peripheral in the retina. So most of the time, you're going to have a granuloma with this. It's just the percentages are where in the retina, centrally or peripheral.
Yeah, and there's some studies that say like the peripheral is slightly more common. I don't worry, you know, about location. Like in my clinical experience, I feel like peripheral feels more common, but you know, it
of course
could be
the one that's more of a hassle to see.
yeah. Though the vitreoretinal complications make it, you know, usually you can find the damn thing. But yeah, that's just like it could basically kind of show up anywhere in the eye, central or peripheral. And then some of the times it just looks like a chronic endophthalmitis. But the reason it would look like that is just, you know, a lot of the time when the child presents is it may not be when there's active vitreous inflammation, but sometimes it'll look like, you know, they'll have active, like look like long-term low-lying inflammation. So they may just have like vitritis, just a lot of vitreous debris. So we call that the chronic endophthalmitis presentation that can mimic like a bacterial endophthalmitis or something like that in appearance. But really, you know, on ultrasound or something, you should, or after the vitreous inflammation is cleared away, you should be able to find the granuloma hiding back there somewhere. So it's really like the commonality behind all these presentations is larva makes it into the choroid, most likely drills up into under the RP, into the subretinal space. Body goes crazy, makes a granuloma. The thing starts to die and cause tons of inflammation, especially in the vitreous, which can create vitreous traction, which is the big difference from toxoplasmosis. And that's like usually the more striking thing that you'll actually see. Like, you know, yeah, you should see a granuloma that's usually, you know, like maybe a half disc, a four disc diameters in size, like it can vary a bit. But, you know, it's a fairly visible granuloma that you'll see. But you'll also see vitreous traction of bands over the thing or dragging from sometimes from the optic nerve to the thing. Like the classic picture you'll see in your textbooks and such is a big vitreoretinal band going from a peripheral granuloma to the disc. That might be causing a macular fold or causing a local traction detachment, etc. So it's that vitreoretinal kind of interface change from this massive inflammation that's really often is really striking about the appearance of this. But just like Andrew mentioned, you know, it's you know, this general inflammation, like they may also just present as looking like they have panuveitis if you don't have a good view into the eye or don't have ultrasound available to find the granuloma. So they might have, you know, they might present, they tell their mom or dad that they have floaters or they have pain or like light sensitivity, like all the classic panuveitis symptoms can pop up. The last presentation that I'll mention that kind of violates all these principles is Doucin, which I think we're not going to go too much into. We'll do a whole episode by itself on it. But that stands for diffuse unilateral subacute neuroretinitis. How I could think of this with respect to Toxocara is it's probably like when the larva is crawling around and the body does not create a granuloma around it for some reason, which is quite rare. Like I've never seen it. I'm a pediatric retina specialist and I've never seen Doucin from what we think is Toxocara. But basically, like in a brief nutshell, you can sometimes see track marks of the larva crawling around in like the subretinal space, causing inflammation and damage and diffuse necrosis of the retina. So that's a possible cause of Doucin, we think. Gross.
Yeah, gross. I was looking at your next line. You've been talking about differentials and things, and you had brought up retinoblastoma, and I was thinking about, you know, Dr. Stephen Flynn has all those great PowerPoints, OCAP review PowerPoints on the Academy website, and he's got like a thing saying, always make sure you know retinoblastoma and Coates disease could be a differential together. Toxocara maybe should enter in as a third thing in that differential.
Yeah. Like in terms of pseudo-retinoblastoma, I mean, I think the most common, we should do a whole retinoblastoma episode. The most common, I think, thing to think about is Coates disease, but Toxocara is definitely on there. Persistent fetal vasculature is also a thing to think about in your differential.
And it's all because of that tractional component, right? I think.
Yeah, the tractional component for the PFV can look fairly similar, but in persistent fetal vasculature, it should be a very specific direction for optic nerve to lens. But sometimes you can get that appearance to it with Toxocara. Yeah, there's a decent differential. I think the biggest thing I would point out in this episode is if you're ever thinking about Toxocara, like if it has all the signs, you're pretty sure it's Toxocara, just think about retinoblastoma, you know, because it can make a retinal mass that maybe you thought was a granuloma. You can get vitreous seeding, which you thought was vitritis. You know, always really think about it, especially as we'll go into in the last section. If you're thinking about doing surgery, you know, your mortality skyrockets if you ever go into an eye with retinoblastoma. So like for your career, if you see a child with a retina thing, for your whole career, always think about retinoblastoma. Like I live my life in terror thinking about retinoblastoma. So I encourage everyone else to, too.
Sorry, buddy. You became the guy everybody refers to.
We have a great ocular oncologist, which is great, too. So I very much appreciate Allison Scala, who's a great teacher and oncologist at OHSU. So before we get into treatment, let's talk about lab testing, because we just talked about some differentials. How do we nail the diagnosis to know what we're looking at? Where should we start, Andrew, in terms of lab testing?
Maybe we can just generally say that nothing works very well.
Yeah. You'd think it would just be like, oh, draw the blood and you'd find out. It's tough. Because a bit about what we talked about, difference between visceral larva migraines and ocular larva migraines, eosinophilia actually usually does not present in ocular larva migraines patients with like the ocular presentation. Probably because there's that like decreased immune response, probably had a lower dose of eggs to start with. So you'd think like you could draw a CBC in their acute phase, and they might have eosinophilia would help you decide, oh, this is like a helminthic, like a roundworm problem. But like, you know, oftentimes they might have a normal CBC, honestly. So you can't go by that. That is helpful though for visceral larva migraines. If that question comes up, you're talking to ID about possible co-presentation. but not really for Olam.
Eosinophilia is like pink, right? I think so.
Eosinophilia.
I think it's pink on the stains instead of purple.
Gonna,
I have this stupid mnemonic in my head brewing that if there's eosinophilia, you're a red-blooded man like Gaston who ate too many eggs. I don't know.
Yeah.
Okay, never mind. Not as good.
Yeah. No. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. Do we stain? I guess we stain the peripheral smear. I guess you can stain a peripheral smear, right?
I mean,
I was going to go by like the machine counting, but I guess the machine can count that. You know how red blooded they. But just pink blood is
pink.
Yeah, because they're red blood.
Okay, never mind, never mind. It's not a Ben Young approved mnemonic.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's good. It's good. You just got to work it a little bit. It's good. So what testing can be done, Andrew, if eosinophilia doesn't help you?
We could do ELISA testing, but it's just not very sensitive in peripheral blood. Plus, the general asymptomatic population, as you had alluded to earlier, Ben, tends to have this at a rate of 14 to 23%, depending which country is studied, I guess.
Right.
All right, what do you do with that if it's positive?
Yeah. Yeah. So like, don't see a patient, draw blood, say like, oh, it's positive, and say, okay, this is definitely not retinoblastoma or something. You know, that's what that means. And it's also not super sensitive. Like they might definitely have ocular larva migrans, but have like a negative serum ELISA test. So what I sometimes do if it's not like a slam dunk from the clinical exam is to test aqueous or vitreous and do ELISA testing on that, which, you know, in a child requires going to the operating room. But that's something to consider. But really, this is usually clinical to diagnosis with supportive history, right? That, oh yeah, my kid was playing in the sandbox. There's a lot of dogs out, like hanging out in that park. We do have a puppy, et cetera, et cetera. And they have the classic appearance of that granuloma somewhere in the retina with a lot of vitreoretinal, you know, either vitritis active, or it's actually more common for them to not present with active vitritis, but for them to present with that granuloma appearance. Because often kids won't know what they're looking at when they have floaters, or they ignore the floaters or whatnot. But maybe the pediatrician noticed like leukocoria, or, you know, it's like they failed a vision screening or whatnot. So they have like vitreoretinal traction involving their macula or something that causes like a fold in the retina that can decrease your vision. So it's like understanding what that clinical diagnosis should look like is super important. Getting supportive history, ruling out other things, especially retinoblastoma. But you can do ELISA testing to help you, you know, to sleep better at night.
This is maybe too much, and you can feel free to cut this out, Ben. Question, if you're trying to get an aqueous or vitreous sample to confirm OLM, but you're also worried about retinoblastoma, how do you guys, like, navigate that?
Living life in terror. I can't tell you I've, like, run into it often. I mean, you know, back in the older days, there were like in K-Series, you know, the Shields group at Wells have done like stole the most work on this. But other groups too, you know, they look at enucleated eyes with retinoblastoma or suspicion of retinoblastoma, and a decent percentage of the time they find it's Toxocara. You know, and they found there's like coats and such. Yeah, we should do like a pseudo-retinoblastoma episode to talk about the whole differential at some point, I think. But, you know, so the biggest thing is understanding what retinoblastoma, how it should present. So it's like more usually of a clinical diagnosis. I would say using the lab testing is more like, can you tell for sure, is it toxoplasma or toxocariasis? That's where I think that differential gets a little tough sometimes, because toxocariasis can kind of look like a headlight in a fog with the granuloma overlying, you know, vitritis. You can't really see if there's, you know, that vitreoretinal bands or traction or whatnot yet. So I'd say the testing is more often used in that scenario. To differentiate for retinoblastoma, I would say is more like, you know, an ultrasound of their calcifications. What is the pattern? What do they, you know, look like? How old is the child? You know, is it, what does the fluorescein look like? You know, there's a number of other things that you would look at. But yeah, like as long as you think about it, or if you're like not sure, have your friendly local, you know, ocular oncologist weigh in on it too. Okay, let's talk about treatment. Let's say you've decided, yeah, this is toxocara specifically. What's the medical treatment we now need to do, Andrew?
Anti-inflammatory treatment, whatever it takes, eye drop steroids, periocular injection steroids, even oral steroids. And the importance of this, you know, the worm is ostensibly there, or the roundworm is there, but it's probably dead. You just want to minimize the inflammation that the whole body is, you know, worked up into a frenzy to be manifesting, especially because all that inflammation can propagate tractional membrane formation, which is what makes this so lovely and special for you, retina surgeon, much different than toxoplasmosis, I understand, in that regard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then, you know, other like uveitis stuff, like dilating drops or vincenichiae, you know, like Mitch, treat it like, you almost treat it like it's like an autoimmune panuveitis, you know, control the inflammation. And it's controversial. Do you actually have to do anti-helminthic medication to try to kill off the larva? There is no study that really shows there's benefit from doing it. In my experience at the institutions I've been to, talking to ID, we tend to just do it. Usually albendazole is a treatment, like 200 BID for a month is what they usually do, which is a very different dose, by the way, from visceral larva migrans. There, my impression is ID will almost always treat with an anti-helminthic like albendazole, but it's like a higher dose for a shorter period of time for that. But I think most people will do it just to kind of try to make sure the darn thing is dead, you know, because like, how do you know if it's dead or not? It's hard to, you know, often like you can't really see the larva in there, like its corpse, like it's hopefully it's getting like broken up and destroyed by the granuloma. But, you know,
I
it's
have an
like,
idea.
Yeah.
For the next time you're operating on one of these things, don't you have intraoperative OCT that might penetrate through the granuloma a little bit?
You
might be able to see if the worm's moving around with that.
Yeah.
Or dead.
Gross. Yeah. If you do, there's sometimes you can kind of see it, you know, you can either like, I don't know if people have seen it moving, honestly, like wriggling, but sometimes you can still see like the little larva, you know, it's like a little, like, you know, it looks like a larva. It's like a little like S kind of configuration, you know, in the thing. People will laser that. Like, I think if I ever saw what I think was a larva, I would probably just like laser it to try to make sure, like, you know, it's like a zombie movie. Like, even though you think it's dead, like double tap to make sure, you know, to kill it. So, you know, that's why, like, you know, we typically will just give albendazole just to help make sure that the thing is dead. And, you know, you can laser it if you think you can see the thing. But, like, none of that's strictly necessary. There's no proof that helps. It's really about anti-inflammatory control is the most important thing. To try to reduce the complications of it. If you get the complications of it, that sometimes you require surgery, right? If you get like a tractional attachment because of the vitreous is condensed and pulling in those areas, sometimes you can get a bad epiretinal membrane. They can get vitreous hemorrhages, you know, from this thing. They can get cataracts, you know, from the combination inflammation, maybe the anti-inflammatories as well. I won't go into, like, this won't be a surgical episode and like the approach to the pediatric, you know, tractional attachment or anything, but a general principle for any vitreoretinal surgery is if you can quiet the inflammation first. Operating at any hot, angry eye is usually a bad idea and should only be done when like absolutely 100% necessary, which is usually, you can usually wait, you know, to try to suppress inflammation. Some people have cut the granuloma out when they're in the operating room. When they send it to path, I think they love it. They'll see like, you know, worm esophagus and stuff in the granuloma from the patient's eye, which is, you know, nice and horrifying.
Is this the time when PATH can't really protest we're not micro?
yeah, exactly. yeah. But some, you know, to get it out of the eye, because you have to get it out through like, you know, usually like a trocar site or something, like a relatively small hole, or like through the vitrector. So usually like they won't usually find like a whole larva from this, but they'll find like the mouth, like the chunks of it, like, you know,
oh,
in
Lord.
Different parts of the sample. Yeah, it's pretty messed up.
Yeah,
anyways,
actually, hang on.
I've never cut one out.
So it is just vitrectomy, like garbage, chewed up, sliced and diced, Cuisinarted stuff. That's all they have to sample, right?
Yeah, because usually I don't think they shouldn't have a granuloma small enough that you could grab it with a forceps and pull it out through a sclerotomy. I mean, I'm to clarify, I've never like tried to take out a granuloma, you know, like I usually it's just like dealing with the vitreoretinal traction.
And to clarify, people generally try to leave the granuloma there, right? They don't usually try to cut it out to give it to Pat.
More like maybe for diagnostic certainty, I suppose. I don't know when I would try to like actually cut it out. The reason to not try to cut it out is if you don't have a break in the retina,
don't go making one.
For pediatric retinal surgery is like, don't make a damn break in the retina. They'll get massive scar tissue formation. Like, that's like the number one rule for pediatric retina surgery is don't make a break in the retina. But people have done it to clarify and like they found this stuff.
Great.
But yeah, I don't suggest you cut it out. Don't do it. Don't do it unless there's a really, really good reason to, I guess, that we haven't covered. Yeah, I think we're done with this horror story.
Yeah. This is, you really pumped Ryan's retina for this. Thank you, Ben. We got the full details.
Yeah, and like literature and stuff too. But yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, a lot of this you don't need to know for the boards, honestly. I hope it's helpful, though, in clinical management. You know, I think to understand like the why and the how a little bit more than like the couple flashcards you need to really make for this. Maybe
flashcards can go really treat with steroids instead of toxoplasmosis, where you treat with all the anti-toxoplasma antibacterials.
Yeah, you need Bactrim, Clinda, etc. And you can use anti-inflammatories too, but it's like the bigger key is usually, you know, to give the antibacterials.
For toxoplasmosis, yeah. Mm-hmm. But Toxocara, it's all steroid management. Similar kind of headlight in the fog appearance sometimes, except that phrase is really associated as a buzzword with toxoplasmosis instead. And in this case, the real distinction is the presence of the granuloma, which, surprise, the worm or the bug, the nematode might actually still be in there. And the biggest distinction is that many more complications from potential traction can happen
in
Toxocara, which can be...
That might be the striking thing.
Yeah.
It could be the picture, you know, is you have like a like kind of yellow-white granuloma somewhere, and then you see like a big band of like a vitreous band or maybe like a retinal fold because a band is pulling up on the retina.
I kind of remembered people talking about the appearance of a Toxocara with like a white thing with a stalk emanating from it. Which is definitely that really, right? Traction.
Yeah. You know, I hope you find a picture. You know, it's not hard to like Google it if we're not painting a good enough picture with our words.
Zombies, yeah, that's like double tapping bugs.
Yeah, exactly.
Picture with words, geez.
Yeah. Those are the, you know, it presents in children. You know, it's one of the differentials for leukocoria, you know, if you're like doing your oral boards and thinking about this. Those are really the highlights. But if you actually see a patient with this when you're on call or whatnot and you're, you know, PDD or whatnot, I hope some of this information is useful to help manage the child. Okay. That's all we have for this week. This is our last episode before this year's OCAP, so all of us from the team wish you the best of luck and hope that some of these episodes have been helpful for you.
Good luck, everybody. See you on the other side.
We'll see you next time. Bye.
Bye.